Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It's 9 o'clock. It's time for a Talk Magic. And I couldn't be more excited because I have somebody now that I'm interviewing on this channel that I have been trying to interview for a long time. She is one of the busiest performers in magic. She has been all the way through lockdown. She is a huge inspiration. She is an incredible sleight of hand artist and a really nice person as well. I am, of course, talking about the legend, Laura London. How are you doing, Laura?
That's the best intro I've ever had. I'm very, very good. And I'm a huge fan of yours too, Craig. So I am thrilled to be here as well.
It's amazing because, I mean, you have accomplished so much. And I want to kind of break that down for people who don't know your career. You've done so much through your career and you perform at such a high level. And also, you're one of the few magicians who became just as busy through lockdown. I mean, you were one of the people that were leading the front when it came to virtual entertainment and sort of virtual shows. You've been busy all the way over the last 18 months, which has been so inspirational to see. So
thank you. I was very lucky. That's the truth of it. I was very, very lucky indeed.
Well, let's start at the very beginning, if that's okay, Laura. I can't imagine there's many people who haven't heard of you. But just for the people who don't know much about Laura London, let's start at the very beginning. When did you kind of get into magic? When did that magic bug bite? What's your origin story?
Well, the truth is, when I was 6 years old, I was diagnosed with ADHD. That's an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, for those that don't know. And I had a particularly bad case of it. I mean, I was bouncing off the walls. My mum really struggled to cope. That was it was difficult, very difficult for her, especially because my father had passed away. So it was just me and my mum, you know, and she'd already at that point already lost quite a lot herself. So to have a crazed daughter to take care of and bring up was very difficult. There was one point where I didn't sleep for weeks. And so I was taken to a special clinic. And in that clinic, the doctors diagnosed me. They told my mum that I was unlikely to do well in school. I was unlikely to, I guess their words were, hold down a proper job. But they did say that if I was into anything creative, I should be encouraged. And they say that to most young people and their parents who have been diagnosed with the same thing. And I was eight years old, basically, when I fell in love with magic. I was at a party, I saw a magician. His name was Colin. He was a kids entertainer and he performed a trick called the Run Rabbit Run. I'm sure you've heard of it, right? The classic of magic. And if you don't know what this is, it's a little trick where it's sort of like wooden contraption with a bunny that disappears and reappears. And I fell in love with it, but it wasn't really the trick or the magician that I'd sort of fallen in love with, although they were both great. It was just the way all the kids felt. I mean, you know, just that show that day made all them kids feel so brilliant, including myself. And when my mum picked me up, I said, I wanted to do that. It's what I wanted to do for a living. And I think, you know, with what the doctor had told my mum, you know, she went, okay, we found something she's into that's creative. So after that, I was just given a, you know, a small budget to spend at Christmases and birthdays, you know, and I just went to Davenport's. The poor guys in Davenport's, they've known me since I was very little. I was literally the eight-year-old buying pen through notes and every kind of card trick, you know, gaff card you could buy. You know, I literally could do 101 things with a Svengali deck by the time I was nine. You know, if you remember that little booklet that was, I mean, I studied that. So I was obsessed. So when my mind was sort of racing and I wasn't able to focus, I would just pick up a deck of cards or the cups and balls or something. And so that's really how I started. Magic was a way of helping me focus. But then it obviously led on to so much more because it's the only thing that I've ever loved in my whole life, really, truly, in terms of something that I've wanted to do. So I was lucky. I fell into it.
Well, here's the thing. You talk about how you saw a kid's magician, and a lot of magicians that become full time, they tell the story about going out and doing kid shows. But we know you, Laura, as one of the best sleight of hand artists in the world. Like that's not my opinion. That's just fact. So when did you gravitate towards sleight of hand? Did you ever kind of try to go more to prop-based magic or kid shows, or was it always sleight of hand that you were most interested in?
No, I think there's a bit of a misconception there. Well, thank you for saying so, and it's very kind that people think so. No, one thing that people perhaps might not know about me is that I have literally been every kind of magician. So at the very beginning, although close-up was always my favoured sort of magic, certainly the magic that I, when I was a little kid, I bought, you know, the cards and things. I was an illusionist. I wasn't a particularly good illusionist, but I had a little illusion act where I dressed as a man with a moustache and a top hat, and it sort of did the cabaret clubs and things. And it was a very Charlie Chaplin-esque silent movie-themed illusion show. So I did that. I love mentalism. So I was a mentalist on cruise ships about 15 years ago. That was pretty much my my role on the ships. But sleight of hand and cards, and it's just always been a passion for me. It's always been there. And it took me a long time to really stop and put all my energy and focus into it, because I was very fortunate to have Faye Presto, who I know has been on this show. She took me under her wing when I was 18. I became the youngest female at that time to become a member. And I walked in and was about to walk out and never come back. You know, it wasn't about that it wasn't particularly friendly. It's just I was really out of place. I mean, at that point in my life, I was just coming out of pretty much a very difficult teenage years where, you know, lots of things happened. And so a punk walked into the magic circle and a punk walked out going, I don't think this is for me. But Faye stopped me. And so Faye was incredible. She gave me her act, like hook, line and everything, the lines, the tricks, everything. Now imagine for a moment how lucky that is, because now you don't have to focus on presentation because she's nailed it. You know, the tricks that she does aren't particularly challenging, but they are effective and unbelievable. So now instantly I've gone in with an act that I know works. And in time, I was able to obviously take those things out, take out all of the lines and replace it with my own. So I, rather than having to learn all of that from scratch, I came in at a very different place. And that's very much down to Faye and some other people around me at that time. So close up has been my thing. And when I've dabbled in everything else, that was always fine. It was 2012. I remember it specifically. I remember where I was. I went to an audition and I didn't get it. And it wasn't about not getting the audition. It's that in that room, and it will be, I won't say who they are, but these are people that you know and that we all know. And I particularly knew one or two of them very well personally. And I'd known them since I was a kid. And I think they were just expecting a lot more from me. I'd become a little complacent. I'd gone, oh, okay, what was it? Like the whole point of this audition was that they wanted someone unique and different. And, you know, it wasn't about the magic. It was about, you know, personality and image. And I thought, surely that was kind of what I was working towards. And I had to stop and take a bit of a, you know, take a look at myself and go, hang on a minute. What were they expecting? What was it? And I think they were just expecting somebody who has been doing it that long to really know who they were and what they wanted to do. So I disappeared for a little while. I literally immersed myself in every kind of book that you could imagine when it came to cards, you know, Card College, Expert the Card Tech, all of them. You got, you know, every card book that I could think of, everyone that was recommended to me, I obsessed over, because really that was what I wanted to do. I've always wanted to be good at cards, and I thought, right, this is my opportunity. That's who I want to be. That's what I need to focus on, and I did.
So in 2012, when you took a step back, were you a professional? You were a professional magician at that point, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I've been a professional magician for 20 years. So
that's a very, that's a very risky thing to do in a way, going, you know, I've already built up this level of success, but I'm going to take a step back because I'm going to try and focus on this one thing and then I'm going to relaunch myself. That's something that's very scary to even think of, for especially as you already had a successful career at that point.
You know, it was, but it was necessary. It had got to the point where I'd already been performing magic professionally for almost 10 years. I had a manager who, of course, would have gone on this ride of change with me, which she did. And of course, we were all very nervous and very anxious about this decision. Bear in mind, I mean, I used to work a lot with other magicians, for example, that I think in some ways perhaps stopped booking me as often because there was the girl that now just sort of did card tricks. That was what she did, you know, whereas before I was pulling out ropes and I was doing all of that kind of magic. And I just went, no, I bet I can create a walk around act with this. I bet I can do it. I bet I can walk up to a table and figure out a way of doing, you know, as you might have a 6 or 7 minute routine or act for each table. How can I do that? So it wasn't just about the gambling stuff that I love that's in my show. It's also just about how can you make this entertaining? Well, it was really simple because it's not about the magic. It's about you. It's always about you. If you walk up to a group of people and they like you instantly, then what you do doesn't matter as long as it's good and it is entertaining. It's baffling, of course, in magic. And it has lots of moments in it. But of course you have that. You know, I could do a transposition, an ambitious card and a card to box, you know, and all of those things with all those moments will suddenly get everybody riled up and going. And now I'm already 5 minutes in, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So there were ways of doing it. And I put my focus onto it. My manager, Jenny, who sadly passed away this year, but she'd been with me for 20 years, went along for the ride, was pretty scared. Like you said, it was a big thing, but it worked, and it worked out, thankfully, in my favor.
That's the thing. I mean, you've achieved so much, you know, the level of success you've achieved in the last 10 years is phenomenal. And people know you now as an amazing cardician. So obviously it worked, and that's incredible. I mean, I want to pick up on one thing that you said there. You talked about the most important thing is getting people to like you. It's not really so much about the tricks. And I've said this on this channel before, the hardest part of magic is walking up to a bunch of strangers that don't know who you are, and within seconds getting them to want to listen to who you are and stop their conversation. And that's something that you do so well. Have you got any advice for people that are watching this that struggle with that approach as to how you can actually get people to like you within a few seconds of actually just turning up and saying hello?
Apart from don't be a arrogant twat. Okay.
Yes.
You know what? There's so many ways, even if you are not inherently that kind of super friendly person, there are ways you can almost fake it, you know, just by having a really good, solid patter. I would say that if you're not that kind of person, don't go ahead and improvise, you know, make sure you have a script that has moments in it and funny moments where you can really use to your advantage. That's always a good thing. If you are an outgoing, friendly person and you walking up to somebody is easy, you really have kind of you're more than halfway there with magic. Anybody can learn a trick, you know, that's the truth of it. You know, we might not be there doing middle deals and bottom deals. You know, you can go into a shop right now. You can buy some really strong, great magic. You can learn it in a few days. But if you can learn how to perform it well, that's the question. You know, you might know the method. It might just have an instant gratification. You're like, okay, that's what happens. It instantly looks amazing. But how do you present that? I think it's all about presentation. So the best advice I've always had is once you've got your act, now really look at the presentation. Look at how you do it. Don't approach people and be arrogant. People don't like that. People certainly don't like you telling them that you are some mystic being either. We're in 2021 now, and you know, nobody believes that we can actually do real magic. So don't treat your audience like an idiot, like fools, you know. You know, halfway through my act, one of the things I say is, you know, look, I am a magician, but I'm a very specific kind. I use sleight of hand techniques. So let me show you. And then I show them something. You know, of course, I'm not giving anything away. But by saying that, they sort of relax for a minute. And they go, oh, okay fine. Admitted that this is just her, you know, and you know, and I'll always say something like, you know, what that really means is I spend far too much time on my own and I have no life, you know. And then you're also, it's about letting the audience kind of feel good about themselves and making sure that they feel like they're doing something and that you're not this extraordinary person, but you're the person that's just like them that happens to have practiced something that hopefully they might like.
That is amazing advice. I have lost count of the amount of magicians that I've seen that walk up and try to convince people they've got otherworldly powers. And it's always been really annoying for me. So yeah, I completely agree with that. Laura, can we talk about branding for a second? Because I mean, I obviously perform in London quite a lot, and the amount of times that I have people turn around to me and say, do you know Laura London? But that's really important, because I've had other people say to me, oh, I met a magician. Oh, really? What's his name? I can't remember. Everybody always remembers who you are. Whenever I go to an event, they immediately know who Laura London is. You built this brand up where people know you immediately. And the problem with a lot of magicians is it's almost like there's this big cloning machine where you put a guy in a suit in, press a button, and another 10 guys in suits come out looking exactly the same, holding a plastic block, doing exactly the same tricks, exactly the same way. And you've built up this brand. Your magic is unique. Your look is unique. And people remember you for all the right reasons. Is that something that happened immediately? Did you, like you talked about being the youngest person to go into the magic circle, when you realized you wanted to do this professionally and Faye took you under her wing, is that something that you realized very early on, I need to have a very strong brand, or is it something that you've built up over time?
No, and I started dyeing my hair when I was about 12, 13. So I'd always been really into particularly the more sort of alternative look, you know. I was pretty much a sort of punk goth, you know, as a teenager. In fact, the image that you see is more of a toned down version of my former self. So I didn't create it. I was told, if you're going to do the corporates, well, you can't have hair like that. So I went, well, I'll keep the red, but I'll change the style, you know. So really, it was just about finding that balance of who I actually was and what would actually be okay in the kind of environments I was working in, i.e. you know, these sort of high-end venues and such. And that was an easy sort of thing, because I'd already had a sort of thing that I was going for without the magic, which was just always standing out, doing kind of interesting fashions. And, you know, I have to say, not all of the choices were very good, right? So you saw the good version of what ended up happening. But throughout my teenage years, boy, did I go through, you know, I went through the cyber phase, you know, I had plastic hair extensions in all luminous colours. But red was always my colour. I was very, very lucky that I had a mum that was kind of a bit more accepting to that more unusual look. So that's how the look started. So that wasn't intentional. That was just me. That was just right. Who I was. In terms of branding, that came a bit later. I mean, I already had a sort of look anyway, so that sort of worked in my favour. I was a woman, so that's easy to remember, I guess, because there's so few of us. I remember where I was when I thought of my name, Laura London. I was in the back of a taxi, actually, after one of the Magic Circle. I don't know if you remember, when they used to have annual gala dinners. They don't do that anymore, but yeah, that's how long I've been a member of the Magic Circle. And we were in the back of a taxi, a little bit skew-iff, and, you know, and at the time I turned up to this event in a full-length latex gown.
Wow.
You can imagine, I was sat on the table with Anthony Owen and all of the Monkey Magic crew at the time, if you remember all of them lot, so Pete, the late Pete McCann and Pete Furman and Ali and all of those were all on the table, and I also had a huge a hair piece that went down to my ass sort of thing, you know. Thought, well, you know, it's going to be the first one I'll ever attend. I might as well make some kind of statement. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm pretty sure it was Faye's idea of me dressing like that. In fact, it was. I said, shall I wear an evening dress or the latex? She went the latex, obviously. So yeah, and they were in the back of a taxi, and you know, and everyone was sort of, we were thinking about a few names, and there was, you know, misdirection. I mean, now there is a misdirection, but it wasn't then. And very, you know, those sort of names. And I was absolutely adamant that I wanted to keep my name, Laura. Didn't want to change it. I wanted Laura as my name. And London is not only a place I was born, I've grown up in. Whenever something bad happened, I would get on a boat on the River Thames on my own, and I'd cry on it and say, right, when I get off, I'm never going to cry about that again. London has been the center of so much of my good times and bad. And it's everything that I love. And I'm also, and I've always been obsessed with the flag, the Union flag. You might call it the Union Jack. It's actually called the Union flag. Few people know that, but it's only the Union Jack when it's flying on a ship. But and that's why I always used to wear it, you know. And so, of course, I just went, I've got it, Laura London. So I think having a good name that can be remembered is possibly one of the reasons people might say to you, do you know Laura London? You know, having some kind of thing that makes you stand out, it makes all the difference. And it is harder if you're a guy. Unfortunately, it just is. We can wear everything that you wear plus more. I mean, of course, depending on what kind of guy you are, but you know, if you're a normal straight sort of, you know, straight down the road guy doing wedding magic, I mean, there's only so much you can do to make yourself stand out, you know, for example. So yeah, it is a bit tough, but that's my only advice. Figure out something that makes you a bit unique and try and do something that will always keep you memorable. You know, really, it should be about the magic and about you. Well, so
that's really good advice as well. Now, you talked about monkey magic there for a minute. Obviously, we think of you as performing at a very high level, like at the upper level of corporates and weddings and whatever else there is. And I'm going to talk about that in a bit. But what would you say your big break was as a performer? You talked about trying to do mentalism. You talked about doing an illusion show. But you've nailed the close-up markets, especially at the high-end corporate level. Did that come, because very early on in your career, you got a show, weren't you? You were part of an ensemble TV show. is that right? I am right, aren't I? Sorry.
Don't tell anyone that, Craig. They might find it online. Yeah, I wouldn't say that was my big break by any means, but if you're talking about playing tricks, it was certainly a good opportunity for me to meet people. So Playing Tricks was a television show. I was 17, 18. It was a young Jez Rose, Keelan Laser. You know, I mean, it was, you know, Loki. I don't know if you remember Loki. Richard, the director's son or something. I can't remember. But anyway, it was a sort of odd bunch, but most of which I think now have grown into, you know, people that are doing amazing things. But the show itself wasn't particularly good, so I wouldn't say it was a big break. But what it was a really great opportunity to spend time with magicians closely, to work with TV people and people in production and stuff, which is really helpful, I think, even if you're not intending to become a TV star, which is something I never really wanted. But just communicating and getting to know those sort of people, you get a real sense of how to put shows together, even in the real world. You know, we might say, I had an amazing guy, the consultant was Clifford Bradley, who owned Crowdstop. He supplied all the illusions and things, and he was really, really wonderful. He actually helped me on my performance for Fool Us years later. Really amazing man. And just being around those people was a great start. It was a really, really great start. But really, my breaks came, not perhaps in the way you'd think it was. It weren't really breaks. I followed a model that faded, and not necessarily intentionally, but I was a big believer in get the best residencies you can, get them in the best venues with the exact kind of clients that you want to book you. And that's what I did. So The reason I say I was the youngest female, I should probably clarify that. Of course, there have been and are younger females in the magic circle. I just happened to do mine on my 18th birthday. That was why. So a week into my 18th birthday, I was, and I'm not sure anyone was that keen to become a member of the magic circle as I was. So I did mine pretty much on my birthday, which is why I said that. So aside from, of course, meeting the right people, being able to go to the magic circle, which allowed me to finally be around people that I guess in some ways my kindred spirits, I found the people that I wanted to work with as well by getting the right residencies. So surrounding myself with the sort of rich, high-end elite of London going straight to the top. So I worked in Marco Pia White's restaurant and various others.
And you know what, when I interviewed Faye for the channel, she mentioned about getting residences. And I asked her, I remember asking the question, how do you go out and get a high-end residency? For somebody who wants to go and get a high-end residency, how do you do that? And she just turned around to me and said, just go and ask them. is that the advice that you would give if somebody's watching this and they're following your advice and they're thinking, you know what, I want to make it big. I want to get in front of the right people.
No, I wouldn't say that. But then that's also not the advice she gave me. And I followed a different model, like I said, that Faye sort of told me. And it has worked. I have changed it somewhat. And perhaps, yes, go and ask. I don't do that. No, what I do is I find the venue that I want to work in. And it doesn't matter if I can't afford it. I make sure I find the money to go there with a friend and eat there. I make sure I sit at the bar and I buy drinks. And I do magic to my friend, because anyone that hires you, they want to feel like you don't need to work there, that you're actually one of them and it would be a privilege to have you there. Like it's a psychological thing. If I can afford to eat and drink there, then I can work there. You know, so that's sort of what goes on in the minds of some of these places. And so another thing I suggest is, if say you don't have the money, you're going, okay, I want to work in this place, go to a charity shop. Go and buy yourself a really nice suit. Or in my case, I used to go to charity shops. I still do. I mean, you know, I'm one of these people. I have a good eye for finding amazing designer dresses that might have been £1,000 and pick them up for, you know, 50 quid. It is a skill in itself, but a good one to have. Sorry, that's a side. But yeah, just go and get yourself dressed well. Go in and be there and be present and do magic, maybe to the waiters, you know, behind the bar, but at least order a drink or something. That's what I've always thought, you know.
Incredible advice. Absolutely incredible advice. You mentioned Penn and Teller Foolus. That was a few years ago now. Not a million years ago, but a little while ago. At that point, when you went on Foolus, you were already performing at a very high level, you know, and we're going to talk about various different stuff that you've done throughout your career. But can I ask you a question as you brought it up? What made you decide to go on Foolus? Because it's always a risk putting yourself in front of Penn and Teller, isn't it? I mean, was there a reason that you wanted to do that, or was it just you wanted to?
Oh, I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it at all. It was the first series that I was on, the very first series. First of all, at that time, nobody realized it was going to be as big as it became. You know, we all just thought, well, forget fooling them. Let's just get a nice 5-minute bit of show reel we can have on our website. That's pretty much what we all thought. Nobody thought anything beyond that. Certainly not that it was going to end up in 10 seasons and every magician on the planet was going to be on it. You know, that wasn't. And it was in the UK as well. You know, we didn't even think it was going to end up in America. So, I mean, I didn't want to do it because when they asked me, I wanted to do close-up. And they said, oh, we've got a lot of close-ups, so, you know, we want you to do something else. I'm like, well, then I'm not interested. But at the time, I was also working the cabaret clubs and some as the close-up performer, but also on occasion some on stage. And I just happened to be at Madame Jojo's doing a cabaret show there called Bête Noire, and I did a stage show. And I did that trick with the lemons, right? So the lemon, you know, walnut, egg and walnut trick. Honestly, I never even done that, you know. I sort of threw it together because I was, you know, I needed to do a sort of 5 minutes and went, well, you know, I've always liked the trick. I thought it was really interesting. And so I did it. What I didn't know was that the guys from Fool Us were in the audience, deliberately coming to see me again to try and convince me to do it. But they were doing that with a lot of people. They were trying to get as diverse a group of people to come and do this first season. And they said, we want you to do that trick. I went, no, I've already said, I don't. And the reason is because that is, of course, not what I was trying to sell as myself. I'm not a stage performer. I wasn't a cabaret performer. I might do that if I want to for fun, but for money and corporates and what have you, you know, I was very much close up. So if I wanted that 5 minutes on ITV, I wanted it to showcase the kind of thing that you might book me for, right? I was selfishly, that was sort of what I was going for. However, my manager, Jenny, she made me do it, and I'm glad I did. It was really, really fun. Like I said, Clifford Bradley, from the guy who was the consultant from Playing Tricks, he helped me out. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to wear latex on Saturday night TV. Why not prime time? Just latex it up and at least get some fun out of it. And it actually worked out all right. But unfortunately, what I didn't want to happen happened, which was then Jenny would get tons of calls asking people if they could book me to do that act, which is what I didn't want. So it was everything I didn't want, and it happened. So there was a very short time where I had to spend a lot of time with lemons.
Oh, dear me. Well, that's not good, is it? Oh, dear me. Okay. Can we talk about your show Cheat? Because this is, you know, every magician that performs or becomes a professional magician, they dream about having their own show. And you've put together a show that has received rave reviews. I've never had a chance to see it myself, but everyone I've spoken to and everywhere on that has ever referenced it has had nothing but really great words to say about it. So where did that come about? What made you decide to, you know, put your own show together? And what was the goal with that?
So 2012, like I said, I'd taken this new challenge on and I'd learned all this stuff, and I particularly fell in love with gambling and all of the sort of gambling books and gambling techniques. And it was something I really wanted to get good at. So I gave myself a deadline. Deadlines are always good. And that wasn't the show. The deadline was the close-up magician of the year at the Magic Circle. So I created a sort of story, this sort of narrative, because I really enjoyed narrative type theatre shows. You know, if you are going to do a one person show, I like it to be a really good story with magic, you know, rather than, I'm just saying for me personally, yeah. You know, I like that. And I like magic to be intertwined with that sort of style. So I created this show. But what it, in this little 5-10 minutes or however long you get for the close up, I was learning the bottom deal. So I thought, well, I tell you what, I have to get good enough to do it by this day, because on this day, I'm going to be doing it in front of all the magicians at the Magic Circle. I didn't win or anything. And I didn't intend to, because look, it was a brand new act. Two, it was a little all over the place, but I did it. I did the bottom deals, and you know, and I just remember when I found I was Guy Hollingworth and all these people with the judges, I thought, I know, right? Can you imagine? But I walked into the theater, and I'll never forget James Friedman standing up from the balcony and went, Laura London, you've got more balls than anyone in this room. You know, there's me doing deck switches, you know, but of course I don't know if you've ever seen a close-up show at the Magic Circle at the competition, but the magicians, the members are actually in the theater watching it on a live feed. So the problem there is I might fool the people around me and next to me, but cameras are a little harder, and I hadn't really had the experience of doing that. So I believe there was a serious close-up on my hands just as I did a deck switch. It didn't matter, though. You know, I think that the respect, just the fact that I did it was something. And that was really where it started. So this story of this card cheat from the 1920s was a 5-10 minute piece that grew and grew. And then I spoke to David Britland, who is a great friend of mine. And I said, look, you know, I want to do this. I want to do a proper show. I want to take this character and I want to create an entire narrative. And then I want to take it to Edinburgh. And I'd not even been to Edinburgh before. So, you know, the whole thing was pretty massive. But again, it was all about just taking all of these things that I'd become really passionate about, all of these new ideas and concepts that I've been learning, and just putting it all into one show, a show that I could be proud of. It's one thing, as you know, going out and getting paid to do corporate events, and we're doing all the fun magic, that's what we do, and it's great, and I love it. So I'm not taking anything away from that. But to actually do something that you have written, devised, put together yourself with the kind of magic that you want to perform, it's really special. So I put everything into it, and I had very good people around me to help me, thankfully.
That's amazing. I mean, you talked about Edinburgh there and taking something to the Edinburgh Fringe. I know that's an aspirational, a lot of magicians, they dream about going to Edinburgh. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that process? Was it, how did that work out for you?
It's incredibly daunting. It's a very lonely place to be if you're on your own. So I went up in 2015 with my manager Jenny, and we went just to recce the place, you know. And also, like I said, I hadn't been, which is crazy, but you know, I just hadn't, and I had to see what it was all about. And of course my mind was blown, going, hang on a minute, what, we're doing this next year, what, with all these people and all these shows, you know? But it was good to get a sense of what it's like. And of course it is mad, and if you haven't been, go, just as a guest, just as somebody who wants to watch entertainment, because there is something for everybody there. It is the most extraordinary thing, and of course since then I've been plenty, but it is an unbelievable place and experience every year. So terror set in, but again, like I said earlier, I love a deadline. So I thought, right, okay, let's do this. Jenny put in everything, we made the artwork, and I had no choice but to put this show together and to finish it and complete it by the following August in 2016. So I did it. I put Cheat together with the intention of, every time I came off stage, I was going to film everyone, go straight back to the apartment I was staying in. I was staying with Lily LaScala and actually Tape Face, who you may have heard of. So I was actually staying with some really seasoned, great performers on the Royal Mile. So I was around good people. You know, it doesn't matter how many good people, how many people you're around, you're still on your own. That's if I was to say anything to anyone, it is lonely. I would go to my room, I would hate it, but I would watch my show. I would write down all of the things that weren't good about it and how I could make it better for the next day, because it's relentless. You know, you do the show and then the next day you're doing it again. And that's happening for a whole month. I didn't even take the Mondays off because I didn't even know that was a thing, you know? So I literally did it, I think 25 shows in 25 days, and just every day did it. And of course it gets better and better, but I had ups and downs. And I mean, like, for example, I had an awful show 20 shows in, and so I have lots of deck switches in my show. I say lots, I've got a few deck switches in my show. And at the time, unlike now where I have a savant, I had just a table with a shelf. I thought that was suffice, like that was fine. And I get a call about 10 minutes before the show, and I'm about to have Richard Wiseman, Guy Hollingworth, David Britland as part, like just magicians and people that I really respected and loved and were my friends, to come and support. Of course, that night, what I hadn't realized is that with my props being with everyone else's props, someone had knocked my shelf off kilter. So I went onto the stage, so you've only got 10 minutes to set up. I literally have everything ready to go, and the shelf just goes bang, and all my cards, every stack, everything on the floor. And I just look at them all like, you know, what can you do? I mean, I didn't even have an out, and I often, and more often than not, had outs, but I sort of hadn't used them. So I thought, well, I'm not going to need them today. Well, of course I did. I'm 20 shows in, and I think I've got somewhere. So it also just goes to show, it doesn't matter how good you think it's getting, or what you don't think you need, you know, be prepared for everything. Because I mean, I've got, you know, I know the three worst shows that's ever happened. I know them. They stick with you, and that was one of them. You know, I covered it up somehow, but not brilliantly. And of course, you know, the show went off, it happened. But with some of my peers in the audience, of course, knowing it was pretty shit.
Yeah.
It's how it goes. So if you do Edinburgh, just be prepared for ups and downs and emotions and all kinds of things. You know, when I had a day where I felt like I'd done a really good job, I don't think I've ever felt better. You know, it was unbelievable. That was 2016, and now I still do the show. So it's a very different show, really, to what it was back then. But, you know, all of those things were really, really important for it to get here, you know.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Wow.
Well, and if anybody is actually genuinely interested in knowing my full experience, I actually did write a journal, and it's you can read it. It's actually on the blog. It's a very honest daily journal of what I did at Edinburgh, and you can see it at cardopolis.com, I think. I'm not sure, but if you just type in Cardopolis, you'll find it.
I'll find it, and I'll put a link in the description. No problem. That's wow. That I'm going to go and read that. I haven't read that. That's amazing. Very quickly on the subject of what you talked about, one question I get on this channel over and over again, Laura, is how can I cope with nerves? I think it's the thing that really affects a lot of magicians. They can practice and practice and practice, and then they walk out, and we all have experienced those shaky hands where you just can't do anything and you feel like you're going to be sick. And it stopped a lot of people who maybe want to become professionals from actually being able to do that, because just the thought of it worries them. Somebody who has constantly put herself into a situation where she's putting herself out of her comfort zone. You talk about, you know, Penn and Teller, you talk about the Edinburgh Fringe. Have you got any advice on coping with nerves?
The truth is, I still suffer with nerves. You know, there's some things I'm nervous about and some things I'm not. You give me an event and a group of people, I can walk up to anyone and I'm not nervous. You know, if I've got these in my hand and all I have to do is entertain a group of people for a couple of hours, I'm fine. I'm incredibly nervous every time I do cheat, because it's my baby. And it sets in, you know, I have the shakes. I think, oh gosh, you know, is it gonna, you know, and the anxiety. Nerves doesn't go away because you've been doing it for 20 years or 30 or 10. It nothing changes that. It's how you manage it. But really, it's about just a belief in yourself and realizing that what's the worst that can happen? You know, it's really sitting down. So I sometimes have to say to myself, you know, when I'm feeling like, you know, this is the worst thing in the world. And even a social media post, people think I'm on social media a lot. You look at them, they're very sparse. I freak out. I panic. I get nervous even writing a post because I'm anxious of what I'm saying and how it's perceived. And, you know, it's ridiculous. That's the truth. It's all ridiculous, because at the end of the day, we can say, do what we like, and what really can happen? What's really going to happen at the end of it all? You know, you go and do a bad show, it happens. I've had several, you know, and I'm still here. I still love magic. And I think that's it. Nerves doesn't go away. It's just how you think about them and how you treat them, really.
I agree. And one of the things that I think that you mentioned earlier, which I think is very important, is when you talked about how you were looking at your show, you were looking back at the footage every night, and you were trying to work out how to make it better. And I think that's something that everybody should do. You know, don't just rest on your laurels, but look at what you're doing and work out a way to make it better every single time.
It's so hard to do that. I mean, I hate watching myself on video. I hate, you know, I very much just, especially in that situation, you know, and also I edit most of my own videos now. So you sort of get to a point where, like, you know, you get used to having to look at yourself, you're editing it, and you're going, well, who is that? Someone going to edit it better than I will, because I know what I want. So now I'm going to have to do it. So I had to get used to seeing myself. But watching myself do shows and filming it in that way, now that's hard for anyone, because you're not watching it to edit for a nice finished product or to sell something. You're watching it to see what you're doing, what you could improve on. That's why you do it. So I think it's a really important lesson, and people should do it more often when they've got a show or their own thing. You know, film it and watch it and write down, here's a good thing to do, here for every one thing you write that needs to be improved on, also write something that you've done well.
Yes.
So I really liked the way I sat, but actually I didn't like the way my hands went under the table. You know, you couldn't see. So even if they're just like little things, perhaps that might be mistaken as you doing something under the table, you know? So there's, try and balance it out. So you're not just giving yourself negative feedback, but you're also giving yourself some positives as well. It's also really, really good to have other people look at your shows and another set of eyes.
I totally agree on so every point that you made. I don't want people to gloss over that either. I think that magicians are so prone to being self-critical. And sometimes we forget to celebrate everything that we've done right and everything that's going well and you know, what we're, how we're performing well. So that's incredible advice. It really is. Let's talk very quickly, Laura, if we can, about you as a creator, because obviously you've created your own show. You created Cheat, and that's a show that you continue to perform. You've got show dates coming up again soon, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But outside of that, as well as creating your own material for your own act, you've created stuff to actually sell to magicians as well. Like your card in bottle is one of like Illusionist's highest rated products, I believe.
I'm not sure about that.
There's tons of 5-star reviews on there, and it's an amazing product.
I like it. I mean, better products than that.
What made you kind of go down that route of creating magic to sell, and what made you kind of go with Illusionist?
Again, not intentionally, really. I had ideas, and people liked them and said, hey, we should release that, or we should do something. It's like that, you know. I'm not one of those people that goes, I'm going to start creating tricks and sell them. I've come up with certain things, and people have approached me and said, you know that thing that you do? Could we package that up and sell it? You know, that's sort of how I fell into that. So it's not intentional. I've got, you know, I've got the Crimson deck out with the Abstract Effect, with the other brothers who are incredible, amazing, amazing guys to work with. You know, I worked, of course, on the card in bottle and several other things. And I've also got a few other things that I'm now working on in collaboration, which I can't talk about just yet, but I will be releasing more. My main focus at the moment is lectures, and I'm, you know, and I've been doing quite a lot of them, but everybody says, well, if you're going to do lectures, you need to have a product to sell. But I don't teach the things I sell in my lectures. So I like the fact, I'd rather just take the fee that they pay me and come out of there not having a dealer dem sort of lecture, but actually a lecture that hopefully you can go away and learn something that doesn't involve you having to come to me at the end to give me money, you know? So yeah, I've got lecture notes is pretty much the only thing I sell in my lectures, and that's pretty standard. It has been for the last few years, and I hope to continue to do that. So I will release products. I'm really excited on this particular project that I'm working on at the moment. Maybe say who it's with, or maybe I'll wait. Oh. I'll wait till later.
Oh,
that was a bit tease, wasn't it? That was a big tease. All right. Well, I tell you what, it is based on some amazing, amazing effects that were hidden gems from back, very, very far back, hidden in magazines and things. So it's one of my passions. One of my passions is to, I have a huge collection of old bound magazines like The Gen and Huguard's Magic Monthly. And I look through them and read them relentlessly in search of hidden gems. So
and now hopefully bringing something to
something. maybe not,
maybe.
Who knows.
What's the best place to find out when this comes out? Is it best to follow you on social media?
Social media. When things come out, I always announce it on Instagram, Laura London 52, like easy to remember, like a deck of cards, like the club 52. We did.
And if somebody wants to book you for a lecture, is it best to go through your website and put in the contact form? Because I know a lot of people that book lectures, they watch this channel. So, I mean, if somebody wanted to, because I have to say, what you said about your lectures, music to my ears. I put a video up just the other day talking about one of the things that really annoys me about lectures is when you turn up and it's a dealer dem and you literally can't go away having learned anything without spending money at the end of the lecture. And honestly, it's so awesome to hear somebody saying, well, you know, I don't want my lecture to be a dealer then. That's brilliant. Where would people go if they want to book you for a lecture?
I'm easy to find. Message me on social media, l@laura.london, my email address. It's easy. Easiest. There's also contact details and stuff on my website. However, that does go to my now manager, but she'll always get information to me. So I'm easy to get in touch with. Very easy.
That's awesome. That is brilliant. Okay, so flipping back again a little bit, can we talk very quickly about the next greatest magician, or I think it's the next greatest magician, because the TV show that you're on next?
Next
great magician.
So close.
Because you were great on there. I mean, you were great. how did that come about? Was that something that you sought out, or?
No? I don't seek out anything. I don't give out business cards. I am the most rubbish promoter of myself. But I've been very lucky. I really, really have been. So that might sound ridiculous to some, because, you know, I'm very fortunate to work quite a bit and do all right out of magic. But yeah, generally, just things. I fall upon things and I either say yes or no. And in that case, I thought it was a great idea. It was a good concept. It wasn't competition. It was a bit of an odd concept, you know, in terms of the fact that the magicians themselves had to. It was actually just before I was doing Edinburgh. So I wasn't able to do well in the show. So I was one of those that had to go in the green room and say, let's just go back for those that don't know the show. The concept of the show is in each episode, a group of magicians do their own act, doesn't matter what kind of style it is, whether it's illusions, manipulation, close-up, whatever it is. And then the magicians go into a green room and decide amongst themselves which one should go to the final, which is sort of an odd thing to do because you've got egos in magic and what have you. For me, it was an easy decision. Don't pick me. I've got Edinburgh Festival next month and I do not have the time to put any more time into this. And but there was a lot of that. There was a lot of, you know, people that were desperate to get into the fight, people that weren't. So the harder you fought, the harder you get in, really, in that sort of situation. But the concept itself, what was nice about it is that there wasn't three red buzzers buzzing you or telling you that you're good or you're bad. You know, you were chosen because you just were good and it was a good act. They had great people behind the scenes helping and consulting, so whatever we needed. And I liked that I did mine pre-recorded. There was a couple of discrepancies that I'm a bit unhappy about in the edit, but hey, I can't say anything about that. What can I do?
Well, I thought it was great. I thought it was great.
Oh, actually, that trick, if you haven't seen it, one of the things I do is I get someone to very fairly take a card, write their name on it. They place it inside the deck themselves. They put it in the box and they put it in their pocket. And I don't touch it. And I really don't touch it. And when they take it out, the card's completely vanished. They do it themselves. They spread the cards. The card's completely vanished. And it ends up somewhere else. And I haven't touched the deck. That deck is the Crimson deck, the deck that I released. So off the back of that show, I had lots of people going, okay, just forget a few things, but how on earth did the card vanish from the deck? So that was sort of how that came about.
Oh, great. And yeah, abstract events have got a very good reputation. So, you know, they're a good company. Okay.
Have a guide.
So can I ask you one other question that I don't normally ask people, but it's been mentioned several times, so I'd like to address it. You've talked several times about your manager, who's obviously sadly passed away earlier this year. I get questions all the time from people who are professionals, or maybe they're wanting to become a professional magician, and they go, how do I get a manager? How do I become managed? I think they love the idea of not having to do all the business side of things themselves and have somebody who does all of that for them, and so that they can just go out and perform. But it's very rare to have a management company. It's not something that every magician gets.
Nobody has one. Well, one, I'm very old school. So my mum used to own a nightclub that used to book magicians and entertainment. And back in those days, having a manager was normal. So I was very much growing up with musicians and bands and entertainers that had managers. So, you know, didn't occur to me that people managed themselves, but of course you can very easily. And that's really the generation I've come from. It's just, I didn't know much of that. I left home and school when I was 15. I was homeless for quite some time, and, you know, and I was very, very fortunate. I got a council flat and you know, my life was changed and saved in many ways. But as a consequence, I had to learn myself. So I didn't really know how to take care of myself. I knew how to be streetwise. You know, that was something I could do. You know, I had to learn to do that. I was homeless. You know, you learn how to live. But in terms of paperwork and like all of that, I literally had no idea. I wouldn't know where to start. So I just had this little thing going. But I do remember when I was a kid, everyone had managers. And at the time, Faye had a manager, which was my manager, Jenny. They sort of parted ways, but Jenny became my manager and stayed with me right up until this year. And I remember walking into her office and saying, I want to be a magician. I'm not particularly good. Well, I might be all right. I don't know. Will you manage me? And she just took one look at me. And I think she probably thought I was a bit nuts. But as we had a conversation, it turned out that she did know who I was. She said, hang on a minute, you're Laura. Are you the daughter of Pauline? And I said, yes. She went, I put the entertainment into your first birthday party. So I was very lucky to have this sort of very unusual, weird thing happen where I happened to walk into this woman's office, say, I want to be a magician, will you manage me? And it turned out that woman had put entertainment into my mum's nightclub when I was young, and also did the entertainment from. So it's sort of meant to be. We always thought it was sort of meant to be in a way. But also my ADHD doesn't help my ability to take care of myself fully. So that was another thing. So I would say you don't need a manager. You've got amazing things like Gigio and all these, you know, these now things that, you know, and most people I know manage themselves, take care of themselves. For me personally, I still do think there is something in you, the entertainer, not negotiating your own fee. I think having somebody do that for you, like an agent or a manager, can always get you more money, because they are allowed to say how brilliant you are, whereas you're not really allowed to do that for yourself. Yeah, unless you're American, in which case they love it in America. You say, hey, you've come to the right place. I'm the best magician on the planet. You know, if we say that over here as a British person to British clients, they go, what a twat, and put the phone down. So we're a different sort of person over here, and we don't like arrogance. So yeah, having somebody negotiate and also chase money. There's nothing worse than the performer who's been paid late having to now say, you know, you're 2 weeks late in the payment. Can you pay me? It's not ideal, because you're sort of here in their mind after a party. You know, you've done these extraordinary things and they think you're amazing. You kind of suddenly become very, very normal and you're going, do you mind just paying me? Because, you know, and then. So for me, that's always been one thing, that even without my specific difficulties in managing myself, I've always thought that there's a huge plus in having a manager do something like that on your behalf. How you get a manager is a difficult one to answer, because most of them don't really, that's not really a thing anymore. You know, managers are agents, and agents are people we can all be on people's books. You know, I'm sure you are, and I am on several agencies, and that's just where you're at now. So I have my best, you know, one of my best friends, she's my manager, and you know, that's how that worked out. She's been, you know, she's been a good friend, a close friend for a very long time. She also knew my manager, they got on very, very well, and when Jenny passed away, she said, I'll do it, I'll take you know, she learned how to do it, and she doesn't, she's doing a really good job. So you can also have someone learn how to do it for you, somebody close, your partner, your friend, as long as you're all right dealing with money in that situation with that person.
Yeah, you just need to have that level of trust, obviously.
You have a level of trust, but also just a level of communication. So Joyce works on, who's my now manager, works on the same commission that my manager did, and that's it. Anything that comes through, she deals with all the contracts, all the money goes through her account, and she just pays me, you know?
Perfect.
I don't have to think about it.
That's great. That's amazing. And thanks. Very, that's great, great advice. It really is. Laura, I want to ask you one other question. You've referenced a couple of times about magical history. I mean, you're recognized as somebody who's really passionate about the history of magic. Do you think that's important? Because you see so many magicians coming through these days, the new magic, they don't care about what's come out 50 years ago. They don't care about Abracadabra, Abra magazine or anything like this. They just want to refresh Murphy's and buy the latest trick that's come out. And that's all they care about. I mean, I also am very passionate about the history of magic. So let me ask you the question, for somebody who's watching this, why is it so important to understand about the history of magic?
First of all, the history of magic is incredibly important, and we should all follow the history of magic. I was very, very lucky to do my talk at the session on Talma, and it was the first historical talk that they'd ever had. But I think there is this thing where I do go to quite a few history conventions. They're extraordinary. I'm 100% the youngest person at these things. I have sat at a table, though, just so we're clear, just so you get an idea of how amazing these things are. I went all the way to Boston. I'm surrounded by, I mean, legends. They are legends. I mean, Ricky Jay would have went to this particular convention all the time, but unfortunately he'd already passed away by the time I'd gone to it. But it's these incredible people, the Mike Caveneys of the world, that go to these things, right? They're not sitting there messing about with cards, trying to have a wank off who's better than, they're all sitting there talking about the history of magic. So one, it's the most interesting thing. It really is, sitting at a table with any of these people, anyone over the age of 80, is just mind blowing. But I mean, I sat at a table in Boston, and this woman, she comes over to me, and everybody knows this woman, everybody knows her. And I don't know how everyone knows her, but she's a star. You know, she's like 90 something. And she sits down and, you know, she's like, I wanna know who you are. And I'm going, I want to know who you are. She's like, I don't see any girls here, you know. And I'm like, well, look, why don't you start by telling me who you are? And she goes, well, she goes, 1930s, I had no job. I was struggling. I was walking down the street, saw a theater. And in the sign in the window, there was a sign that said auditions today. So she blags her way in, and she becomes Harry Blackstone's assistant for the next, I don't know, 60 years. She was the moth. The moth was Harry Blackstone's. So, you know, it's, first of all, it's fascinating magic. Everything that we do, doesn't matter how original you think your product is or your act is or something that you've created is, there's something similar before. And I think it's very important that we, as creators of magic, creators of show, we acknowledge that. We're only going to be able to do that by speaking to the right people and doing our research. Research involves history and looking at things and working things out. You know, there's too many times I've seen people think that they come up with a move, you know, and then, you know, what they don't know is then you've got someone amazing sitting there, you know, that's 80 years old going, that kid thinks he's amazing, does he? I saw that trick in 1943 by, you know, and so it's really important, history, but also, it's just glorious. It's just, if you're not interested in the history of magic, you're an idiot, because it is unbelievable. My particular love is in Mercedes Talma. She was the first female sleight of hand performer. Houdini said that she was the greatest sleight of hand performer that ever lived. That is what he said. You know, this is a woman. She was written out of history for the most part because of male journalists. So it's nothing to do with magic or magicians. In fact, amongst magicians, she was highly respected and talked about. So, you know, some people have very different opinions on women in magic than I do today. But I believe we've always existed. And actually within magic, there's been a huge respect, you know, for people like Anna Eva Faye and all of this. The respect went down when the quality went down for some time. But now we're back, and hey, there's some great females doing magic now, and that's amazing. But the history is a really wonderful thing, and the things that can come out of reading it. For example, my research in Mercedes Talma, ended up with me becoming very, very good friends with Paul Keeve. He's now one of my best friends because his passion was in Serve Le Roi. And between us, we found out something that no one in magic history had discovered. We found out that Serve Le Roi and Mercedes Thelma weren't married, even though all the books said that they were and that they said that they were. In actual fact, he was married to somebody else. They had a child, he abandoned them. And on the Magic Circle stage at the History Collectors Day, myself and Paul, we brought the two families of Serve Le Roi together after 100 years. You know, unbelievable things come from just small little bits of nuggets of knowledge, you know.
I can see how passionate you are. I can see how passionate you are. That's amazing. That's fantastic. This has been an incredible interview. I want to ask you a couple more questions very quickly and then we can wrap it up. You've spent the last year, I referenced this at the very beginning of the interview, you spent the last 18 months really kind of very busy with virtual gigs, while a lot of magicians were kind of sitting around waiting for things to happen and just hoping things would get back to normal. You kind of attacked the situation and you were leading from the front when it came to virtual entertainment. I've discussed virtual magic and virtual shows on this channel an awful lot. Do you think it, and I get this question daily at the moment, do you think that virtual magic is here to stay? Or do you think now that things are opening up worldwide and hopefully we're kind of getting back into a certain degree of normality over the next few months, do you think that virtual magic is just going to fall away and cease to exist? I suppose the question is, if somebody's not put a virtual show together, is that something that they should consider doing?
No, I think if they haven't already, don't bother, you know. I 100% believe, though, that it's here to stay. So I fell into it very, very fortunately because Jägermeister had a campaign called the Save the Night campaign. And they were paying people, not a lot of money, but they were paying magicians and all kinds of artists, graffiti artists, mixologists, DJs and stuff. They had a collection of artists and performers. And the idea was that we had to do, or I had to do, in my case, 20 shows a month. The people that I was performing for didn't have to pay a thing. All they had to do was go on the Jägermeister website, book the slot, and I would jump into their party. Now, bear in mind, at this time, lockdown was a new thing. We were all scared. Everyone was isolating. It was the most extraordinary into virtual shows because there was no pressure. I was literally jumping into a birthday party for a group of people that would have 100% been together in real life, but couldn't be because of this new weird thing that was happening to the world that nobody understood. And so they were having parties on Zoom, and that was a huge thing, especially at the beginning. It's not quite as popular now, but it was a huge thing. So, you know, I mean, there was sometimes it was really emotional. I jumped into one party and the woman was in Germany. It was her 70th birthday. And they had a huge party organized. And now she was completely on her own. Her family were all in different parts around the world. They were all going to fly in. They couldn't. And now I got to do a bit of magic for them. So in the end, I did 3 months, that's 60 shows in the first 3 months of the virus hitting the world. And as a consequence, I got a show. I found it pretty easy to transition. But then I also didn't, because it was so new and so quickly I jumped in, didn't occur to me to do virtual magic tricks, like tricks created for, so I was literally doing my act on Zoom. And now, even to this day, when I just did one the other day for a big conference, you know, I still am doing things that you can, that if you book me in real life, I'll still do. I'm not using technology or anything like that. On the occasions I have, it's not gone down that well. So for me, that wasn't a thing. I kept with using things that are absolutely my ability to do in the real world, and it served me really well. A lot of people don't like it, and it's not as good as being in front of real people. Of course it isn't, but it is a platform that's here to stay. I did enjoy it, and I have enjoyed it. I've found a way. There's some platforms I don't like using, some I do. Zoom's very easy, whereas Blue Jeans isn't, you know, so there are things that are a bit rubbish, like I don't like Microsoft Teams. But here's the thing, just imagine those conferences where they would fly delegates from all around the world to Munich, say, you know, and the cost of that was huge. You'd have maybe 500 people that you're paying for hotels, even just the laminates alone costs thousands, programs. Well, that's not necessary now. You know, these platforms, instead of having 500 people in a venue and paying all this money, you can have 3,000 people all around the world jumping in on Zoom or whatever the platform you're using, still have a bit of entertainment, still have fun, still have all the speakers at a fraction of the cost. So that's not going anywhere. I do believe that. It's definitely here to stay. But as for the private parties on Zoom and all that, I think that's definitely, it's already out the window, I think.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. I completely agree with you. And you know, obviously you're performing live again now. Can we quickly promote the fact, because I know that for people that haven't seen your cheat show, you've got dates in August. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And people can book tickets on your website.
So I'm doing three dates with five shows in August. Each show is incredibly intimate, no more than 20, 25 people per show. So I'm not outwardly trying to push it in any major publications because I kind of want it to be as small and intimate as it was always intended and written. So that's how Cheat was meant to be. And it's how I'm doing it next month. You know, I've done Cheat in Paris, in France for hundreds of people. I've done the Welcome Collection in front of 500 with screens and things. I'm stripping it down completely to how it's supposed to be. No screens, just you all around my table and me telling you the story of Geraldine Hartman and doing magic. So if you do want to see that, there are a few tickets left. We've added a few. So if you do want to come along, there's a few tickets. And you can get the tickets on my website.
And I'll put a link down below in the description. Exactly, yeah, absolutely. So one last question for you, Laura, and this has been an incredible interview, it really has, but I want to ask you one last question, which is, what's next? And what I mean by that is, I know you say that you've fallen into things, but you've fallen into things over and over again, and you've had an incredible career. You are so well respected, both by lay people, by your clients, but also by magicians. You know, the amount of stuff that you've done, you've been on front cover of Genie magazine, I believe. Is that right? You've been on the front cover of Genie or Magic?
Magic. Genie. That's old school. Yeah. I was on Genie. I was just in Vanish. I've been very, very lucky to.
Covers. You've done so much and you've achieved so much. If you decided to call it a day today, your legacy is set, but I know you're not going to do that. Is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you have yet to tick off that you're aiming for in the future? You said that you like setting yourself goals. Are there any goals in the future that you're aiming towards? You talked about releasing more products, hidden gems, and trying to bring that to the forefront. I know that's something you're very passionate about. But outside of that, is there anything else that you're wanting to achieve over the coming months and years?
Well, one, I will never leave magic. It's what I've always done. It's the only thing. It's the only thing I've ever been in terms of work passionate about. And you know, I will be that old lady that goes up to a table at a history convention or something and tells my story to a bunch of young people. I hope, anyway. I will always be in this incredible industry. In terms of what I'd like to do, I'm writing a new show. I will tell you what it's called.
Please.
It's called Laura London's Missing. And that's all you're going to get from me about that. But I'm writing a new show, which I'm very, very excited about. I wrote to Cheat. Now this is the second one. So for me, that's it. It's a huge thing. It's going to take a while. I've started, but it's going to, you know, it's not something that's imminent. It's something in the works at the moment. I have, I have lots of things I want to do. I want to write a book. I want to work more on myself, work more on my magic, work more on my shows. I also work with Breathe Magic, which is an organization which uses magic as therapy, initially with young people who have hemiplegia. Just in lockdown, we've been working with people now in mental health sectors, and I intend and hope to be doing that for certainly the long haul. It's an incredible organization and something, probably the thing I'm most proud of being part of. So I have no intention to stop, whether it's using magic to help people or just to continue working on myself and the way in which I perform.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I know whatever you decide to do, you're going to be hugely successful because you have this ability of making something happen. thinking about it, envisaging it, and making it happen. And that's so inspirational. One other question that has just occurred to me while I've been speaking to you, if you don't mind me asking, revisit one thing. You've referenced several times about you wrote the show script, Cheat, you're writing another show. I see so many magicians that wing it and they don't script or they don't write anything. As a final question, have you got any advice for anybody who's watching this that wants to tighten their performances up, or maybe they want to put their own show together? As somebody who's written their own super successful show and they're in the process of doing another one, is there any advice that you can offer on that?
I think it has to be the sort of thing you want to do. You know, not everybody is into that sort of scripted type magic. If you are the kind of performer that wants to do trick after trick, and no, that's a whole different genre of magic, and that's different. If you want to script and write, I will tell you now, I don't have any GCSEs. I was awful at pretty much every academic subject. I have had to work extra hard just to get to a point where I could write a show. So if you're, and I'm sure you are already beyond that, because you probably have got more academic skills than I do, you're already ahead of the game. So if I can do it, you can do it. It's as simple as that. I think it's really important to surround yourself with the right people. You can write a show, but it's always good to have somebody read it, look at it, and not necessarily a magician, actually. I would say go outside of that and get people that are honest, brutally honest, and will really help with giving you constructive criticism that you can then move forward and create the best show you can. Listen to people, don't just listen to yourself.
That's great. That's great. And what a wonderful place to end the interview. Laura, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. I know how busy you are. Trying to get my calendar and your calendar to mesh has been very, very difficult. So I'm glad I've finally tied you down. Thank you so much for coming on the channel. I'm going to put all of your social media down below. I'm going to put links to your show tickets down below. I'm going to put a link to the Crimson Deck and to everything else that you've done. I really encourage everyone to follow Laura and support everything that she does, because you are great. You know, I think magic needs more people like you, Laura. So thank you so much for coming on the channel.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to be here, and thanks for asking me along. I really appreciate it. You have a wonderful, wonderful day, and thanks, guys, for watching.
Laura, you're amazing. Guys, leave a comment down below, because I'm sure Laura will see it. Let us know what you think, and I will be back again tomorrow at 9 o'clock with another video. So I'll see you guys again.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.